Hello, and welcome to the Nauticast podcast, the one true chapter-by-chapter podcast going through A Song of Ice and Fire. I'm one of your hosts, Emmett, also known as Poor Quentin.
And I'm your other host, Manu, also known as Manuclear Bomb.
And welcome to the 216th episode of the Nauticast, titled Grinding Axes, an analysis of A Storm of Swords, Jon 9, in which the evil turncloak Jon Snow takes over Castle Black, only for the brave heroes Janos Slynt and Alistair Thorne to arrive and bring him down.
Lysa Arryn, Janos Slynt, Marillion, Alistair Thorne, all of our favorites are finally back into the story.
And soon we're going to get back to us to Steel Shakes Walton, and then the Tickler is there. All the hits, we're playing all the hits. So our spoiler warning, as always, prepare to be spoiled for all five A Song of Ice and Fire novels, the three Duncan Egg novellas, and the histories, interviews, Winds of Winter sample chapters, as well as Game of Thrones and House of the Dragon, the TV shows. Anything and everything. Our question this episode comes from our patron, George of the Mountain, who asks, if I remember correctly, we have heard Emmett and Jeff have a discussion on Donald Noy's discussion of the Baratheon brothers with Jon. I and the rest of your listeners would love to hear Emmett and Manu's unique dialogue on Noy's metaphor. Thank you all for the podcast. So yeah, Donald Noy, who recently departed, RIP, in the last Jon chapter, one of his more famous moments is talking about the Baratheon brothers. In terms of metals, of course, he's an armorer, so of course he makes that metaphor. Talking about Robert as the true steel and Stannis as kind of brittle, as being more iron, like strong, but also more brittle, inclined to break rather than bend. And Renly as shiny copper that is nice to look at, but not worth all that much. So do you think that was on point, or do you think maybe it's just been too long since Donald Noy checked in with any of those boys to really know what was up?
Yeah, it's interesting because I think we're inclined to trust Donald Noy's judgment on things. He seems like a wise and leader type. But I also think all of us would agree that Robert, in the ways we would conceive of as true steel, probably kind of falls short of that. I think it makes sense in the way that Robert is really the synthesis of those two characters as a political figure. And because we've talked about on this podcast that the politics are very personal. They're wrapped up around these people because there really isn't a state apparatus otherwise. So these people kind of stand in for the ideals and the ideology that informs the kingdoms. So Robert is able to embrace just enough of that affable outwardness that Renly has with some kind of adherence to either chivalry or knighthood or just the warrior culture that Stannis is a little more, you know, likely to embody than Renly is. So he kind of is able to kind of split that middle, even though he's clearly unexceptional in any real way as a political figure. As a military leader, he's fantastic. But as someone who actually has to sit down, build coalitions, govern day to day, discuss policy, he's clearly not there. I'm not sure, you know, Renly and Stannis are interesting cases on the policy discussion because we kind of don't really get to see it that much. In different ways. Like Renly, we just kind of don't have that same window into it. With Stannis, there's a lot of religious fervor around his thing, but we're also, you know, they're focused on conquest at this point. They're not really focused on like establishing a political order. And I think that's kind of what's the fun part of Stannis coming north at the end of this book and the beginning of the next book, is because that's actually seeing him really do some politicking, like working with the Mountain Clans, working with Jon, whatever, you know, Melisandre is doing with Mance Rayder, I think kind of falls into that milieu of Stannis politics. So, you know, I think the jury's a little still a bit out, but I think Robert's just someone who's clearly someone that the people can believe in as a sovereign in a way that kind of matters. And I think we have to give a little bit of credit to Robert here. The entire like bonding of the Seven Kingdoms under the Targaryen hegemon with dragons at the forefront of their power, for that to crumble away and then eventually for that family to be overturned who had ruled Westeros for 300-ish years, and then for Robert to essentially hold together that quote-unquote revolutionary coalition for 19 years or so, that isn't nothing. That really isn't nothing. And, you know, a lot of that is Jon Arryn. A lot of that is Lannister wealth. A lot of that, I'm sure, is Stannis as Master of Laws as well. But I think there is something there that Robert was able to hold together something, at least serve a purpose to a political system in a way that Stannis and Renly are currently lacking. I think Renly now will forever lack. And Stannis, the jury's kind of still out, but we do expect him to, you know, probably blunder in the end, you know, rip Shireen. But I think we're going to see that he's able to not fully bring it together either.
I think, yeah, a lot of great points there. I think that what Donald Noy says right before he says all that is instructive, because he says, you know, Robert was he was a good sword, but he kind of, with some men, when they get put up on the wall, they go to rust or something like that. And so it's like Robert himself said, that he was alive when he was winning the crown, but dead once he won it. And he just didn't know what to do with power. In the same way that, kind of ironically, Cersei, for all that she hates Robert and contributed to his death and suffered as his wife, she kind of has the same problem. But I love what you said about Robert kind of being the synthesis of Stannis or Renly, because I think the comparison there, it's important to put it in the timeline and realize that Stannis and Renly kind of only become important after Robert dies. And you do very much get the sense that he's been kind of been split apart, and that what Stannis and Renly are both really lacking is each other. Like, they would both, like, what Renly needs is someone who can give kind of teeth and weight to his policies and carry them out and make sure they're done. And what Stannis needs is someone that people can stand talking to for more than 30 consecutive seconds. And that's Renly. So, like, that's why it's so, like, silly and petty, but also really sad when they fight. Because it's like, the two of you together, you'd be unstoppable if you could just put your bullshit aside. So I think I think in isolation, Robert as the true steel, I think clearly his kingship suggested otherwise. But the idea of him as, I think, as wasted potential holds true. And then once that's gone, you kind of only have Stannis and Renly. And that really what Donal Noy is saying about them is that if you put them to the test, it's not going to last. Because, yeah, I mean, Robert, for all his faults, his actual kingship went pretty well. It was just afterwards, when it revealed he'd let all the problems metastasize, that things got really bad. But that specifically Stannis, if you put him to the test, would rather die than compromise, which is what Donal Noy is really saying there.
Yes.
And that Renly, when you put to the test, will turn out to not have any ideas at all, which I think we also see, because when Stannis shows up to Storm's End, Renly's like, oh, I better go confront him with like a quarter of my guys really quickly with no food. Whatever.
Sure.
Why not? Catelyn says, Ned would never have let Robert make that mistake. This would not have happened with Robert. And that's so that it's less about Robert was actually great and more about like this melancholy sense of, oh, all we've got left are his pieces. I think Donal Noy has a strong sense of that. And I think it's, of course, important because Jon has to try to transcend all that shit, which will be harder when he has to deal with Stannis, of course, in the flesh. So thank you so much to George of the Mountain for the question. If you want to ask us questions, we are forced to answer here on the Nauticast podcast. You can head on over to patreon.com/Nauticast, ASOIAF, where our patrons get benefits, including early access to our regular episodes, exclusive episodes every month, and the chances to ask us questions at the top of our regular episodes. But we are here today to talk about A Storm of Swords, John 9. So let's jump into the synopsis. Day and night the axes rang. John could not remember the last time he had slept. When he closed his eyes, he dreamed of fighting. When he woke, he fought. Even in the King's Tower, he could hear the ceaseless thunk of bronze and flint and stolen steel biting into wood. And it was louder when he tried to rest in the warming shed atop the wall. Mance had sledgehammers at work as well, and long saws with teeth of bone and flint. Once, as he was drifting off into an exhausted sleep, there came a great cracking from the haunted forest, and a sentinel tree came crashing down in a cloud of dirt and needles. Oh, that's fine, it's just the wildlings getting their Christmas trees early before Stannis shows up and sets them all on fire. Owen announces the dawn, and Jon and the other men in the warming shed atop the wall silently prepare for the day ahead. They're just too tired to talk at this point. They're in that shed because it's just not practical for everyone to keep going up and down the cage. Castle Black itself now belongs only to the wounded and those too old to fight. John steps outside and looks down at the wildlings going through their own morning routines. They have tents and horse lines set up now, with warriors sharpening their swords everywhere John looks, and he knows that there are many more hidden from his gaze beneath the trees. Speaking of morning routines, here come some wildling archers to fire what Pip calls their breakfast arrows. John hasn't exactly been in a joking mood himself since, well, ever, but he encourages Pip's jokes, repetitive as they are, because at least it distracts his comrades from thinking about what happens if one of those arrows reaches them, as happened to Red Allen of the Rosewood 3 days ago. At first, John used his own arrows, fire arrows, to set the archers' shields ablaze, but Mance quickly caught on to that and started covering the shields with raw hides. Thankfully, there are still plenty of literal strawmen named after absent watchmen for the wildlings to shoot at. I say thankfully, but let's be honest, it would be a whole lot better if those guys were actually here, where they belong. John walks over to the telescope that Maester Aemon used for stargazing before he went blind. John gets a closer look at the wildling camp, noticing Val and a very 9 months pregnant Dala outside Mance's literal big tent. He also takes a look at the siege engine that they're all calling a turtle, basically an upside-down ship covered in hides and pelts. The wildlings plan to walk the turtle to the base of the wall, hiding from arrows underneath the hull, hack through the door with axes, and break into the tunnel beyond to reach the other side. Tormund is managing the project, and by managing, I of course mean he's eating half a goat while yelling at his extremely large sons to do the actual work. At least he's a better leader than Bowen Marsh. John just got word that Marsh fought a spectacularly bloody battle at the very well-named Bridge of Skulls, losing 100 watchmen and getting himself wounded. John sent Zay to Molestown to ask the villagers for help, but she just ran for it instead, and honestly, can you blame her? Next, John checks in with Gren, who has grown bigger and stronger than the boy whose ass John kicked in Book 1, and is now sporting a shaggy hairdo that would make Jason Momoa jealous. John forces Gren to get some rest before forcing himself to eat some breakfast, knowing that it's a bad idea to face battle on an empty stomach. Speaking of battle, the turtle is suddenly on the move. John commands Kegs to blow his horn twice to summon the other watchmen, who are all just as exhausted as John. The last thing he wants is to lose the gate and force those poor guys to die down in the tunnel like Donal Noy did. The turtle approaches. Pip tries for a joke about turtle soup, but even he's not laughing at this point. Where's Dolorous Head when you need him? John is just glad Mance is holding back on the mammoths today. Their death throes are horrible to see, and even worse to hear. John dispatches men to the catapults and scorpions, ordering the rest to start firing arrows, though he knows all of that will probably be useless. And sadly, he's right. No matter what they do, the turtle keeps coming, slowly and steadily winning the race, as turtles tend to do. They need boulders to crush it, and while they don't have boulders, they have the next best thing. Barrels full of gravel that Gren poured water into, freezing them overnight so they won't come apart if they smash against the wall on the way down. Gren and Kegs push the barrels down, one by one. By the time they were done, the front of Mance's turtle was a crushed and splintered ruin, and wildlings were spilling out the other end and scrambling for their camp. Saturn scooped up his crossbow and sent a few quarrels after them as they ran, to see them off the faster. Gren was grinning through his beard, Pip was making japes, and none of them would die today. On the morrow, though, oh, don't worry, John, that's later. You might be dead by then. Speaking of which, John feels like he honestly might die if he doesn't get some sleep. One cup of dream wine later, he's passed out in bed, only to be rudely interrupted by a handful of men he doesn't even recognize. They drag him to what was once Elsie Mormont's office. John sees Maester Aemon, Septon Celador, Sir Winton Stout, as asleep as John wishes he still was, and a bunch of other watchmen who he doesn't know. Except one. Immaculate in his fur-trimmed cloak and polished boots, Sir Alistair Thorne turned to say, "Here's the turncloak now, my lord. Ned Stark's bastard of Winterfell." Boo. Everyone with me. Boo. And who is this my lord Thorne is talking to? He is a jowly man who John has never met, but sadly we have. It's Janos Slynt. Once again, boo. Slynt is sitting in Mormont's chair, the fucking nerve, and he promptly accuses John of oath-breaking and desertion while beyond the wall. Maester Aemon speaks up for John, but Slynt wants to hear John's explanation for himself. John tells the truth, that he went scouting with Corrin Halfhand, who ordered John to join the wildlings and learned what he could about Mance's plans, especially regarding the Horn of Winter. But Slynt, naturally, is more concerned with forcing John to bow and scrape and use the right titles to address him and Thorne. Slynt says he's commander here at Castle Black until Bowen Marsh gets back. Real lesser of two evils is still evil situation there. Slynt then brings up Ygritte. John still mourns her too deeply to deny their relationship happened, and he admits that he broke his oath with her, but denies he ever turned his cloak, claiming he never took up arms against his fellow knight's watchmen. Unfortunately, Slynt and Thorne have a prisoner who knows better than that, Rattleshirt, who John doesn't even recognize at first without his bone armor. Rattleshirt confirms that John killed Corrin in order to join the wildlings. John says that Corrin ordered him to do whatever the wildlings asked of him, but Slynt and Thorne don't believe him, concocting a conspiracy theory in which John was part of the mutiny against Elsie Mormont, and Benjen Stark is out there with Mance right now. As a longtime reader of A Song of Ice and Fire, I wish Benjen Stark was out there with Mance right now. That would be great. Septon Celador adds just a pinch of bigotry to their paranoid hallucination soup, noting that John set his vows before the old gods. Oh no, apparently. Maester Aemon, the voice of reason, again speaks up, pointing out that the old gods are the gods of the Stark North, as well as the wildlings, and arguing that John is the only reason Castle Black has held long enough for Thorne and Slynt to get here and start ruining everything. All Slynt can say to that is that John's a traitor like Ned before him. John can't stand for that and declares, correctly, that Ned was murdered. Slynt orders John taken to an ice cell. Sir Alistair seized John by the arm. John yanked away and grabbed the knight by the throat with such ferocity that he lifted him off the floor. He would have throttled him if the Eastwatchmen had not pulled him off. Thorne staggered back, rubbing the marks John's fingers had left on his neck. You see for yourselves, brothers. The boy is a wildling. And that is the synopsis for the extremely frustrating Storm of Swords, John 9. What do you think of this one, sir?
Well, if you watch pro wrestling, this is a familiar tale. The valiant face or hero struggling against overwhelming odds and persevering and perhaps about to win the day, maybe with a choke slam as John was about to do. And then someone runs down the ramp, someone ostensibly on the hero's side, and hits our hero with a leg drop or a steel chair or a pedigree. Hulk Hogan was that asshole at 1996 Bash at the Beach, Daniel Bryan at SummerSlam 2013, and now Jon Snow experiences that same fate at WinterSlam 300 ACE. Maybe not an elegant metaphor, but
I love it.
I don't really have any other way to describe this chapter. The last several of Jon's, we've seen him grow as a leader, as a strategist, as a brother to his fellow Night's Watchmen. He's kept morale high, he's made the most of meager resources and meager men, and he's turned back every battlefield innovation Mance has to offer. So it is nothing short of a steel chair to the skull when Jano Slint and Alistair Thorne run into the ring and toss John out of the squared circle and into an icebox.
Every time one of the Night's Watchmen says brother like Black Brother, from now on they should say it like Hulk Hogan. That's in my head, headcanon from now on. So our last episode with Sansa 6, you were talking about how that chapter, even though we're still in a Storm of Swords, of course, kind of kicked off Sansa's A Feast for Crows arc. And this one feels along the same lines, like it's the beginning of Jon's A Dance with Dragons arc as Lord Commander of the Night's Watch. It is less exciting and emotional than the last couple of Jon chapters. There's nothing even approaching Ygritte's death here. But that's deliberate, because George wants to show us what being in charge looks like after the excitement has faded. Your emotions have gone numb along with your body, and yet you still have to get up day after day and do the job of keeping your people alive. When we get to A Dance with Dragons, George emphasizes John's dissatisfaction with the compromises of that position, as he yearns for something more cathartic and also just less complicated. Here, those compromises haven't really set in yet, so it's more about the sheer physical and mental exhaustion John has to keep working past, and the little victories that help him do it. But the punchline is the same here as it will be in A Dance with Dragons. John's real problem isn't the wildlings, it's the assholes in his own ranks. In this case, Jano Slint and Alistair Thorne, who I only wish had stayed away longer. Two books is not nearly enough.
Mm-hmm. They come with fire, they come with axes, biting, breaking, hacking, burning. Destroyers and usurpers, curse them! Ah yes, the classic game of who said it, Jon Snow or Treebeard. They don't have watches in Westeros, but the constant mining, shoveling, pickaxing on both sides of the wall is basically ticking away the hours until the next major battle. The Watch is spending what manpower and resources it has to refortify its defenses at the gate, while the Free Folk are doing everything they can to tunnel from the other side.
And, cutting down every tree they can to use for their siege engines, to use for the turtle, as they call it. And I like that comparison to the Ents, because generally speaking, the Wildlings and the other First Men are closer to the trees than the Andals are. The First Men worship the old gods, the gods of the woods and the rivers and the rocks. The influences there on George's writing are pagan and even animist, and it was the First Men who made a deal with the Children of the Forest. And then you get the Andals, with their faith of the Seven Who Are One, George's riff on Catholicism overthrowing the pagan religions. And then you get the backlashes to that, which take various forms, exist on various levels, the Children creating the Others, the Wildlings' perpetual rebellions, even Robb's revival of the title of King of the North can all be seen as different versions of the Return of the Repressed. The old, weird Westeros waking up in the North and rising against the New World, the Andal hegemony of the South, which is so strong that even when the Targaryens took over, they adopted the faith rather than impose Valyrian gods. And in all of those cases, George identifies tipping points where the righteousness fades into something more complicated. Most obviously with the Others. They're the easiest to hate of all the forces sweeping down from the North. They're the most exaggerated, inhuman version of the Return of the Repressed. They're the ones who have spun most dangerously out of control to the point of threatening literally everybody. They're the quintessential cure worse than the disease being humanity itself. But that pattern applies to the human factions that sweep down from the North as well. And George always zeroes in on war itself as the corrupting force. What war makes you do eats away at the reasons you had for fighting it. Like, Rob rides to war for good reasons, right? Certainly compared to the Lannisters and Stannis and Renly, like we were saying earlier, have their own kind of problems that undercut their claims. But Rob, when the War of Five Kings starts, he seems like the good one. He's likable. He's brave. We're encouraged to cheer when he's crowned king. Screw the Lannisters. They killed Ned. Go get him. And Rob says later that in that moment, when they crowned him, he promised himself he was going to do it right. He was going to be a good king. And he just doesn't know how it got confused. And maybe if the Brotherhood had managed to return Arya to him, Thoros could have told him, as he tells Brienne, that war makes monsters of us all. Mance and his people are the most sympathetic version of this pattern, in large part because they're the least powerful. They're cut off by the wall, they've come south to hide behind it, as Mance says in the next Jon chapter. They're the underdogs relative to both the Others and the power players of the South. Mance has to cross the wall, or literally all of his people will suffer a fate worse than death. Those are the stakes here, and it's hard to get more urgent than that. So George has to work overtime to complicate this situation, to get us to understand how war is a race to the bottom, even when absolutely necessary, because blood will out, and you cannot keep your hands clean. Which I think is his overall point with the Wildlings. Men are men, as Davos and Maester Pylos said, that great conversation a couple Davos chapters back. The point is not that the Wildlings should be treated better because they are stereotypical noble savages with a more enlightened way of life. The point is that the Wildlings should be treated better because they're humans, no better or worse than the people on the other side of the wall, and yet they're currently being treated as subhumans. So even though the Wildlings are closer to nature, closer to the trees, they still have to chop them down in order to create the siege engines they need to get past the wall. And the point is that if the wall weren't there, this wouldn't be happening. Just like the new fence being built around that village in the last Arya chapter, the trees are getting cut down there because of Tyrion kind of sparking up the war in the area near the Vale. Just as the small folk suffer when the High Lords play their Game of Thrones, the trees suffer in the endless war between the Wildlings and the Watch. And even when Stannis shows up to put an end to that war, declaring that when the cold winds rise, we must live or die together against our common foe, the trees get no respite. Stannis orders the Wildlings to burn weirwood branches in order to earn a place in his realm. Because R'hllor has no place for the old gods any more than the Seven did. Even as one faction rises and another falls, the overall situation from the perspective of the trees, from the Lorax, from Dr. Seuss, it gets worse. Whoever wins the war is going to inherit a lesser world than they started with.
And all of life has devolved to war on the border of Westeros. Waking life is full of fighting, and sleeping life is full of dreams of it. I think we can all relate to John here, at least in terms of how a singular focus throughout your day kind of fucks with your dreams. How many times have you played a video game all day and then had dreams of playing it all night? I know Tetris and Halo specifically have done that one to me. And all that fighting, day and night, waking and dreaming, is tiring. And let's be clear here, John is fucking tired as shit. His account here reminds me of those RAF fighters during the first parts of the Battle of Britain in World War II. In those early days before radar and aircraft tracking were really a thing, RAF pilots basically had to stand by round the clock to turn back bomber raids by the Nazi Luftwaffe. These early raids were generally minor in the broader context of the war, which is not unlike these Wildling assaults on the gate in this chapter. But the pilots would have to be ready all the same to respond as soon as an attack was imminent, and that's something we're going to see here in this chapter as well.
Yeah, I think everyone can relate to that feeling of, like, especially trying to get to sleep the night before you have to do something important, mm-hmm. and then you can't get to sleep, so then you start panicking about how you're not going to have enough sleep to do the thing, and then that just keeps you awake even more. Losing sleep messes with your head in the best of times, let alone in the middle of what is a seemingly endless battle. And George does a great job getting across just how exhausted John is. How time itself seems to have been suspended because his brain and body can't break it down into sleep-wake cycles anymore. And it's the fighting itself doesn't even revive John, right? He can't even count on, mm-hmm. like, that spike of adrenaline you'd get from the battle fever because it's all at a distance. So his body isn't aware he's under threat, so it has no reason to wake up. And it's just so repetitive. In a way, John feels almost like one of the whites here, like he's being controlled like the zombies the Others use. All of his normal human actions and reactions have been numbed. He's running on fumes. He's only going through momentum and instinct at this point. And yet, even that's not enough. Because John isn't just one of the Black Brothers anymore. He's in charge, which means he has to constantly perform leadership. In his last chapter, when Donal Noy left him in command, that performance seemed to come to John out of nowhere. Suddenly he was just giving a big damn hero speech. In this chapter, we see the aftermath, when nothing is coming to you out of anywhere, and you have to force yourself to act like someone worth following. All through the chapter, look at how George writes this. He doesn't write John smiles. He writes John made himself smile. He doesn't write John eats. He writes John made himself eat. He writes John snapping himself back into giving orders mode whenever he almost passes out, which is a lot. None of this is coming naturally. Leadership is in large part about confidence, and confidence is a con. It's something you fake until you make. This is the John I think that Donal Noy saw in him. You can't just assume your skills and experiences make you the protagonist of reality. You have to earn command from the people you're trying to command. And this chapter is a gauntlet for John because it forces him to earn it until he drops.
Yeah, I really love that because we have that phrase natural born leader, right? And we just assume like some guys just have it. It's like, no, they like put the work in, whether it's, you know, having a good administrative mind or knowing what to say at the right time. Those aren't always just things that come naturally. Those are social and thus they have to be learned to some degree. So I think that's a nice little challenge that George is throwing into that old maxim. And also, though, it's not just John who is tired. It's everyone. And it's not just individuals who are tired. It's institutional fatigue. The Night's Watch, even at its full strength in 300 AC, is a sorry lot. And they are nowhere near full strength, even for their meager numbers. Between the massacre at the Fist and the mutiny in Craster's, Bowen, Marsh, and company out elsewhere, their already paltry numbers are further lessened. And those men, you know, Bowen Marsh, we learn, was injured turning back an attack of the Shadow Tower, that just further puts them behind the eight ball. Supplies are low, the pitch is gone, the oil's all but depleted, and arrows, John notes, are not far behind either. So, and while, you know, Castle Black could theoretically be easily resupplied, the chaotic situation in the north makes that pretty unlikely to happen. So basically living on top of the wall, you know, kind of strands them from doing anything like foraging nearby or, you know, doing that resource procurement or supply chain management that's super important to these like prolonged military efforts.
And all of that is going to keep telling even after Stannis temporarily saves the watch because they still have to carry on their duties with these problems. Not enough men, not enough resources. All through the story so far, George has emphasized that the watch is on the edge of extinction. So yeah, when you hear that 100 brothers die at the Bridge of Skulls, you immediately wince. Like, 100 men might be a rounding error in Tywin's army, or Renly's, or more to the point, Mance's. As Jon thinks Mance has so many fighters, he can throw a fresh wave for every attack, while the survivors of the last wave rest up. But for the Watch, 100 men is a big deal, especially after they lost so many of their best men north of the Wall, like you said. And it's, you know, we hear that 300 wildlings died in that battle, but that is not good enough. That 3-to-1 ratio, the Watch cannot survive that for long. The odds will just keep getting worse. All they can rely on is the defense multiplier of the Wall. The Wall defends itself, as everyone says. But in practical terms for this chapter, that just means the world shrinks to that hut on top of the Wall. And I kind of like that effect, that the wall might be a wonder of the world, but for John in this chapter, it's just his office now. It's just where he's got to live and get up and make decisions and go back to sleep. And it's kind of demystified. And you see John thinking about everything that's wrong with it. Like, we should have built hoardings. There's all these things that we should have done to make this defense multiplier everything it could be. And we just didn't.
Oh, yeah. No, that reminds me. When I was an auditor, one of my first audits was in the Sears Tower, which, you know, growing up in Chicago, it's like, this is the world's tallest building and always has been until, like, the Burj Khalifa went up and all that. And then you start going there every day to do fucking audit work. And you're like, my God, whatever charm, wonder there is to this, completely gone, completely eroded. It's been subsumed by the menial things that make every day suck. But maybe looking at the other side of the military situation, you know, the wildlings have it slightly better, even though they haven't made any real progress as of yet. Like the Watch, they're basically having to do with what they have, you know, stripping the carcasses of their dead mammoths for materials and furs. And like you mentioned, they just have numbers at this point. And it's John basically equivocates it or makes it equivalent to an iceberg. He can only see like essentially 10% of the army. The rest is lurking in the haunted forest. And he, you know, spies who he can, including Val and Varamyr Sixskins, who we know will both play bigger parts in A Dance with Dragons. But I do want to give a quick shout out to the boys chat, basically Pip and Gren, who in John eyes have become men themselves in this very short time. Boys to Gren, if you will.
My favorite band.
Pip is a glue guy. He's like a Kirk Heinrich, the old Chicago Bull. He just kind of holds everyone together as he's making japes and naming the scarecrows for their absent brothers, making a game of the breakfast arrows, just things to kind of pass the time and deal with the monotony of this prolonged siege. And that helps alleviate the fatigue we've been talking about and the fear they have of just being in constant warfare. Gren has taken his moniker of Orox to heart, turning into a giant shaggy beast. And it's you really see, you know, John's storyline in Dance of Dragons is going to be like, kill the boy and let the man be born. But you see, like, big or small, everyone kind of has to do that duty as well here at the Night's Watch.
And I think John kind of misunderstands Aemon's advice, the kill the boy advice, when it comes to his friends. He thinks he has to give up those relationships, or at least keep them at a distance. You can tell he thinks friendship is one of those childish things he has to put aside to you know, to let the man be born. But the reality is, as we see in this chapter, that John's goofy sidekicks are essential to his leadership taking hold, in large part because they're not just goofy sidekicks anymore. John sees their potential growing alongside his own. And I think George does a good job with Pip and Gren, because it's not like they completely change overnight. Their maturing strengths are natural extensions of what were once signs of immaturity. Pip's jokes used to indicate a lack of depth, a sign that he wasn't taking any of this seriously. But now, as John recognizes, that his gallows humor is absolutely essential to keeping up morale, especially without Dolores Ed here to do it, because that's usually his job. Growing up isn't about giving up your sense of humor, of course. It's about recognizing that it's not all about you, the funny guy with the microphone who gets the spotlight. Pip has come to appreciate the social function of humor. The glue, like you say, a way that it helps everyone, not just you. Gren's size used to be a problem for him. He kept getting in his own way. He was clumsily tripping over his own feet. But now he seems comfortable in his own body, in a way that Sam is very, very gradually getting comfortable in his own body. Now Gren's a bruiser on par with the Umbers and the Clegane's. Now he's essential, because he can lift and push things that no one else can, just as no one else can tell Pip's jokes. They've found their place. And John is able to see them in a new light, focusing not on how he feels about Pip's jokes, because it's pretty clear he still finds them annoying, but he's focused on how other people feel. Like I said, George keeps writing in this chapter that John is making himself eat, making himself smile. But there's one moment where John doesn't have to make himself do it. He genuinely smiles, and that's when he's leaving the wall and he says, "Pip, the wall is yours." And Pip goes, "Me?" And Gren goes, "Him?" Exactly the reverse of the last John chapter, when John left Gren in charge. And Gren went, "Me?" And Pip went, "Him?" And in that chapter, they were both, like, scared. Like, really? Gren's in charge? But in this chapter, it's so clearly a joke. It's so clearly Pip and Gren riffing on the fact that they're not scared anymore, and that they can trust each other, and it's going to be okay when John goes to get some sleep. That's great. There's no competition between them. There's this trust. Like, that's brotherhood at its best.
Mm-hmm. Well said. Well said. When the turtle attack comes, we get to see the battle of resources and technologies and the counter resources and technologies deployed and the bootleg military innovations that each side has to come up with. Things like using hides to minimize fire arrow damage, using pebbles and ice and barrels to replicate boulders. It's very survivalist, very scavengerish, looking for anything for a possible advantage. But this is also what gets John thinking. In seeing the shortcomings of the wall's defenses, he's thinking about, we shouldn't have to do these things. We should have institutional structures, defenses that are more than just let's, you know, freeze water overnight and drop it on people. I mean, it's great. It's innovative. That's wonderful.
But you shouldn't have to. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. If you had some kind of warning that Mance Rayder was coming, you know, south to assault the wall, you would just think to have more if you possibly could. I know the North and everything's kind of fucked everywhere right now, but it just... Yeah, he's doing the true seeing, as Cyril Farrell would say. He's observing what's actually happening. It's not just the battle in front of him, but it's the next battle and every battle that comes after that as well.
As Mance says in the next John chapter, no man goes hunting with only one arrow in his quiver. John uses every tool in his toolbox methodically, one by one, even the ones he knows will probably fail at the job of actually stopping the turtle. Because if nothing else, it gives his men something to do as their tomb crawls closer, so they're not just thinking about being screwed. And we see that with Mance, too, on the other side of things. You know, he's He's kind of a structuring absence in these couple of John chapters because he's not, you don't actually see him, but you're constantly seeing the result of his decisions. And you see he works kind of along the same lines as John. He's a bard king. He's a performer. And he knows that keeping his people together is about giving them things to do, about giving them room to vent, as well as all the logistical details of actually getting them to safety. That's why Mance pretends to have the Horn of Winter, not only to bluff the Night's Watch, but also to bluff his own people, to convince them that he's ready to take down the wall if that's what it takes, even though, as he admits, that's actually the last thing he wants to do. Then in this chapter, John pulls his ace, like Donal Noy setting the stairs on fire, which we didn't realize was going to happen until it happened. John really thinks this through. You can tell freezing the barrel specifically. George lingers on that grin, going, why do we have to do that? John explains his logic very clear. It reveals the results of his training at both Winterfell and here at Castle Black. And it works. George lets us really feel that moment of camaraderie. I love that line when Pip and Gran are joking and laughing, and John thinks, even though John is like, you know, the gloomiest of all these guys because he's responsible for all of them, he thinks to himself, well, we're not going to die today. And that's all he can do. That's all he can get, because tomorrow is always going to be tomorrow. So it's always going to be something unexpected. They're not going to die today is the highest standard, I think, for a leader in John's position. And he gets there.
Yeah, and he even earns himself a little bit of a nap, which I hope was very good and refreshing for him, because it's his last comfy nap for a while.
Sigh.
Alistair Thorne and Janos Slynt make their reappearances in our narrative for the first time since middle of the Clash of Kings, early middle, I'd say. And it's effective insofar as I had totally forgot about them the first time through, and then I went, oh yeah, them. but things have been a little too chummy on the wall for the last couple of John chapters, as we said. Since John's return, it's been mostly reunions and the brother at arms growing together, very band of brothers-y, like we talked about with Pip and Gren earlier. You know, sure, you know, Donal Noy has died and Maester Aemon did some sharp questioning about what John was up to beyond the wall, but it's generally been a good time, all things considered. I wouldn't call it a good time, but you know, everyone within the wall is kind of cohering around yes. John as uh-huh. leader. But, you know, not Alistair Thorne and Janos Slynt. Oh, no.
Nope.
For John, those are chickens that have come home to roost. In addition to the, you know, ongoing battle with Mance, we now have the internal conflict with the Watch, which is going to be really important. Like you say, this is basically a lead into the A Dance with Dragons narratives and John's eventual assassination by his brothers. And this is all another side effect of that institutional fatigue we discussed earlier. That exhaustion makes the organization very, very, you know, open to fraying from within. In fact, the latest new Learned Hands podcast episode is about John's assassination and exactly that, the institution is and how it's disintegrating in that exact moment. Slynt, being the shithead that he is all about the kind of enforcing the social hierarchy, constantly telling John to refer to Thorne as Sir and himself as Milord in the small folk pronunciation, no less. As we glean from A Clash of Kings, the Tyrion chapters, Slynt is absolutely a social climber, and his betrayal of Ned Stark was meant to position him and his family for even further social climbing. All that was stripped away by Tyrion, not only taking that future away from him and his family, but also sending him to a place where titles and lordships should not matter by definition. And while we've discussed previously that the Night's Watch's commitment to egalitarianism is more rhetorical than actual, Slynt doesn't even care to acknowledge the rhetoric. He's a lord. He's supposed to be a paramount lord as owner of Harrenhal. And if he can't have that, he sure as hell will swing his privileged dick around here at Castle Black. Slynt and Thorne have no compunction against using anything and everything to slander Jon here. They use his relationship with Ygritte against him, even as he's still suffering from that loss. As you say, he's still truthful about it because, you know, that trauma is still processing in his heart. They use his Stark name against him, with Benjen Stark for no reason catching a stray in the process. Like, what did he fucking do? He just disappeared.
Like, I haven't even been here for two books. What did I do?
He's like that Lenny joke. It's like, I just got here. What's going on? And, you know, they even tried out, like, Rattleshirt as witness. Like, fucking Rattleshirt. You know, it's all kind of giving the same vibes as Tyrion's trial a few chapters ago. Like, Ritz Mall, you know, in the Tyrion parlance. You know, bogus witness and events presented without context. They're enough to condemn Jon. And that's in spite of, you know, Maester Aemon's truthful and somewhat fiery defense of him.
It's so funny what you said about seeing Slint and Thorne and going, oh, right, them. I had that same thought first time through this chapter. I'd completely forgotten about both of these guys. And honestly, I was happier that way. Thanks a lot, George. And I got to think that's intentional on George's part, that feeling of, you know, suddenly the pit in our stomach dropping out, especially after emphasizing the camaraderie among John's men, the sense that they're really coming together as a unit thanks to his leadership. Only then does he pull that rug out, reminding us that the Night's Watch is not just an isolated band of bastards and orphans fighting the good fight. Like you said, for all that, L.C. Mormont claimed that the Watch was one big family in which your past lives and your past names were put away, the reality is that the Watch is an institutional reflection of the cultural norms and social hierarchies of Westeros. It kind of has to be because the rest of Westeros is where they get the men from. Mm-hmm. And this is especially bitter at this point because the Iron Throne has essentially abandoned the Night's Watch, at least under the Lannisters. The power structure Slint is upholding when he tells Jon to call him a lord, that power structure doesn't care about any of them. And that's the great irony here. Slint is claiming lordship because it was granted to him by the same royal government that sent him here. And look, sure, you can argue that knighthood is eternal, that there's something like kind of romantic and individualized about that, that Sir Alistair Thorne is always going to be Sir Alistair Thorne, and you can't take that away. But come on, Slint was Lord of Harrenhal for like 10 seconds, and he never even went there. It's so transparently absurd that it's impossible to take him seriously, which is a problem for Jon. Like, there's no way for Jon to talk to this guy. He's so obviously incompetent. He's not a worthy opponent. You can't even really negotiate with him in good faith. And he's here with his puppet master, Alistair Thorne, Slint and Thorne. I just love those names. Together, they're like child, like they're like Dickens villains, Slint and Thorne, or like Roald Dahl, like a Bogus Bunsen Bean in Fantastic Mr. Fox, or the aunts in James and the Giant Peach that poor orphan James has to go live with after his parents are eaten by a rhino, which is something that just happens in England apparently. He has to go live with his aunts, Aunt Sponge and Aunt Spiker. That's what they're called, which is like Slint and Thorne. It's deliberate because they're supposed to be like irritating and obvious in the way that kids' villains are, and Jon has to deal with them. But the sting in the tale is that they're not just inventing reasons to hate him. I mean, they are. Like, that whole bullshit about Benjen is just the most ridiculous thing. But they are also drawing from the things Jon has actually done. And they are things that we only know better about because we have his POV, which is where this lines up with Tyrion's trial and all the kind of Tyrion realizing that they're telling half lies about him, kind of more dangerous than outright lies. Like, Jon really did kill Corrin Halfhand. That looks bad. He really did ride with the Wildlings. He really did break his vows with Ygritte. And if I was a random Night's Watchman, I might not believe his whole thing about it was all for the Horn of Winter either. But then Maester Aemon speaks up, the only one there who can, ironically, see the big picture clearly. Like, if Jon really was a turncloak in league with the Wildlings and the Mutineers and probably the White Walkers too, why has he been fighting this whole damn chapter to keep Castle Black in the hands of the Night's Watch? If Jon really was the guy Slint and Thorne keep saying he is, Uncle Slint and Uncle Thorne, why wouldn't he just have opened the gate to Mance Rayder after Donal Noy died? Slint and Thorne claim to want to hear Jon's explanations for themselves. They bring in Rattleshirt as a witness for the prosecution. But the reality is that, just as Tyrion is on trial for being a dwarf, Jon is on trial for humiliating Alistair Thorne, who sees the chance here for his revenge. And he's also on trial for being Ned Stark's bastard, as Slint still resents Ned's attempt to buy him, scarcely dreaming, like Tyrion said, that you were already bought. All these petty personal slights. Like nothing else is going on here. Like nothing else matters at the Wall right now. Like I said, this is the big punchline. After spending the last couple chapters doing everything he can to stop Mance from crossing the Wall, Jon gets thrown down by his own comrades, who can just waltz in and take over because they're on the right side of the Wall. It's a perfect illustration of the injustice at work here. This isn't about what Jon has done, any more than keeping the Wildlings penned up beyond the Wall is about what they or their ancestors may have done. It's about who they are, the wrong kind of person. Same with Septon Celador's comments. They're telling, he almost never speaks up because he's too drunk, but he has a line here about how Jon, you know, he said his vows to the old gods. Like, that is supposed to mean something bad. Especially in the context of the North being so close to the Wall, but that's further evidence for the prosecution that Jon just needs wrong vibes, just doesn't smell right. And the way they talk about him, like Jon Slint says, I know the ways of wolves, connecting Jon to the Starks, but then Alistair Thorne calls him a wildling. Well, he can be kind of whatever we want him to be as long as it's bad. As long as we can tell ourselves he's other, that's all we need to do. As though we wouldn't all be furious as John at this point when he goes after Alistair Thorne at the end of this chapter. And yeah, the last line is Alistair calling him a wildling. And it's like, at this point, for all, even after John's been fighting the wildlings all chapter, like, better a wildling than to be one of these assholes. Like Ygritte says, you may call us a thief, but at least a thief has to be brave and clever and quick. All a kneeler has to do is kneel. And these are two dyed-in-the-wool kneelers right here.
So, moving into foreshadowing and groundwork, Owen the Oaf mentions that he had a dream that King Robert came and saved the day. And I think John briefly has that flash of mind when he sees Stannis's men start streaming into the battlefield before the charges of Stannis start rising up over the din.
It's a great moment, really well set up here, because in the moment you're just like, oh, poor Owen doesn't, you know, they told him Robert's dead, it's not getting through. But then in the moment when John sees the Baratheon banner, he's like, Robert, who I know is dead? What's happening? And it's just great that even in Stannis' moment of triumph, still someone thinks, Robert, the important Baratheon has come to save us? Oh, good. Like, you know, obviously there's probably no way Stannis ever found out about that, but it would make him so mad if it did. So that's a beautiful bit. All right, so moving into a theory and discussion. Obviously, we have our two little Night's Watch villains come to the fore here, Janos Slynt and Alistair Thorne, Uncle Slynt and Uncle Thorne, trying to stop Jon Snow from fighting the good fight. Janos Slynt departs the stage early on in A Dance with Dragon when Jon removes his head. But Alistair Thorne is still alive in the books. He was sent off by Jon on a ranging mission beyond the wall, like halfway through the book, through A Dance with Dragons. One of those scouting missions, all the men were killed, but we still don't know what happened to Alistair Thorne. In the show, obviously, he is the leader of the assassination attempt on Jon and is executed for it. But his fate remains open in the book. So what do you think is going to happen with him?
Like so many characters, if Jon's Targaryen parentage gets out there, Thorne as a loyal Targaryen during the Civil War, it's just like, what would that do to his mind? Like, what would that do to their relationship? So it's one of those things where you kind of want to see. And with that, you know, moment where Jon orders execution of Janos Slynt and Alistair Thorne kind of steps aside. And he also, you know, goes along with Jon's, you know, like he goes out on the ranging the way that Janos Slynt, like, refuses to follow Jon's order. Alistair Thorne does follow his order. So it's like, I kind of like maybe the idea that maybe he has a redeeming moment. Even the show gave him a couple of those. It totally made sense to like rope him into the Night's Watch mutiny at the end because they're just limited with cast and we all hate him. Owen Teal makes such a great lovable villain. But he also had moments of like, I was unsure about things, John. And, you know, sometimes I just had to stop, you know, questioning myself and just lead, like that Battle at the Wall episode. And then he's able to rally the men and fight, you know, against Tormund Giantsbane and all that other stuff. So I do think he sucks. Like, he clearly sucks and we're not supposed to like him. But I feel like he's got a surprise in him just yet for us to be like, oh, okay. Like, he's a shit, but at least like he could do the right thing every now and then.
I agreed across the board. I like that bit in Watchers on the Wall in the season 4 episode where he's like, yeah, we should have blocked the gate like you suggested. He says, giving Jon a compliment like it's literally killing him to do it. But he still does it. Or yeah, like he genuinely leads the Night's Watch into combat. You know, he's not leading from behind. And then, yeah, I also agree that it made total sense for the show to make him the leader of the mutiny because we recognize him. And I really like the idea in the book that it's Bowen Marsh, who is not as obvious a threat as Thorne or Slynt. And it's just kind of this bureaucratic guy who's more boring than anything else. But slowly the hostility has crept up to the point where he takes that step. I don't think that would ever translate to screen. Like, the sneering drill sergeant is exactly the villain you want for that. You immediately know who that guy is as soon as you see him. That works very well. But yeah, that moment you highlighted that happens in Dance when Thorne lets Jon execute Slynt and doesn't seem exactly beaten up about it either. Yeah, that shows that, you know, he's definitely smarter, as Jon recognizes, and that means they can come to an accord and maybe work together. And yeah, his fate is mysterious. He says he'd come back even as a white. That might be foreshadowing. Maybe he'll get killed. Maybe he'll come back as a zombie. But I like the idea that you said of him learning that Jon is Rhaegar's son and going, God damn it. That means he's probably my king, isn't he? And I can see it. Maybe he dies for Jon against the others, you know, when we get to the big battle showdown at Winterfell. I could see that being a thing where that suits his character. And that's just enough. You don't need a full-on glorious redemption. You know, like a minor version of what happens with Theon.
Yes, exactly.
Potentially with Theon around the same battle. I could see that for sure. So that is going to wrap us up for our episode on Storm of Swords, John 9. Thank you so much for listening. As always, if you want to drop us a rating or a review on your podcast app of choice, we really appreciate that. It helps us find new listeners. You can check out our Patreon at patreon.com/notacast, A-S-O-I-A-F, where our patrons get benefits, including early access to our regular A Song of Ice and Fire episodes and exclusive episodes every month. You can follow us on Twitter, Blue Sky, Instagram, at notacast, A-S-O-I-A-F, or shoot us an email at notacast, A-S-O-I-A-F, @gmail.com. And you can find me at Twitter, Blue Sky, at @PoorQuentin.
And I'm Manu, at Manuclear Bob. We're back covering The Lord of the Rings over at My Brother, My Captain, My Podcast.
Hell yeah. So coming up next on the Nauticast, our latest Star Wars episode, third one on Empire Strikes Back. That's out right now on our Patreon for all of our $5 and above patrons. Next week is going to be the next Fever Dream episode, covering George R. R. Martin's 1982 vampire novel on Chapter 30, one of my favorite chapters in that book. That episode's going to be out for our patrons next week. And then next time in A Song of Ice and Fire, it's A Storm of Swords, Tyrion 10, in which, hello, my name is Oberyn Martell. You killed my sister. Prepare to die. Yes, it's that chapter. It's finally time for the Mountain and the Viper.
Yeah, no, that's going to be a lot of fun to cover. It's an explosive chapter and a lot comes out, so I can't wait to get to it.
Me too. I've been looking forward to that for a while. So thanks again for listening. We will see you next time in Westeros for A Storm of Swords, Tyrion 10.